Hey there, fellow warriors. I have another episode, yay, with my son, Sean. And I know that these are some of your favorite episodes when I chat with him. Maybe I should just give him the microphone and I can like go do something else. You just like listening to him, don't you? But guess what? This episode is airing on March 6th. And March 6th was the second best day of my life. And I'm not saying it was the second best, but it was only the second best because I'd already had a first best. Only because Jamie was born before you. But the second best day of my life was when Sean was born. And today's his birthday. So happy birthday, Sean.
Thank you very much.
Isn't that weird to think today? Oh my gosh, you are 36?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. And Jamie died when she was 30.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
I remember you saying to me one time when you said, I just surpassed Jamie. I just became older than my older sister. That seems like yesterday when you said that to me.
Yeah. Well, it was my 31st birthday. So it was 5 years ago. Because that was what quantified in my head was I realized I'm officially older than she was when she died. So she was murdered before being even given a chance to make it as far as I have. So every year on my birthday, it is a little bit of a bittersweet day. It's nice that people will recognize you and all that, but it is always in my mind on my birthday every year.
I bet. I'm sure it is. You know, when you become an only child overnight, which that was another thing that you brought to my attention at one point in this bizarre journey we've been on, when you said, you know, Mom, one day, overnight, I became an only child. And of course I knew that, but I'd never, I don't know, the way you just said it like that, yeah. It hit me.
Well, so my cousin Shawnee and I talked about this. Her brother was hit by a car and killed about a month prior to Jamie being murdered. So Shawnee lost two people, actually, that she was really close with.
Can we just stop for a second? The only reason Sean didn't lose that cousin, too, is she came...
Yeah, it was cousin on her mom's side, not her dad's side, who's related to me. So he and I knew her brother, but not very well. But she was very close with my sister. So the point that I'm getting at is I was talking to her at her husband's birthday dinner the other night. And I said to her, it's very weird when there's only two people in the world that exist that are half your dad and your mom, and then there's only one. And I told her there's times where I'm surrounded by 30 people and I feel alone because she's gone. And she understood exactly how I felt because she had experienced the same phenomena. So, yeah, it's been, it's just strange.
Well, so it's kind of interesting because we've talked before about Jamie's death, obviously, and we've talked about addiction a lot, but I feel like we haven't really talked about the loss to that extent. The kind of deep things that you're thinking about, how it's always sad to lose someone and you grieve and everything, but when you have these kind of epiphanies where you go, you know, Rich had one. So, you know, I had Rich, who's Sean's stepdad, I had him on an episode a couple weeks ago, and we kind of talked about our journey. And in that, he touches on it. It was kind of like, oh yeah, oh, by the way, my brother died when Rich had just turned 15 and Bradley was 13 or something. They're a year and a half apart.
Yeah, they were 14 and 13, I believe.
And it was like
8th and 7th grade, whatever age that is.
Yeah, and he overnight became an only child. But it never, I don't know, for some reason I had never thought of it in that way until you said that. And then I went, wow. So I don't know how that feels because I've never had that happen. Plus I have 4 siblings.
Mm-hmm.
But Rich knows how that felt.
Mm-hmm.
To suddenly be, like you just said, she's the only person that I share the same DNA with.
Yep. Yeah, nobody else was 100% related to me the same way that Jamie was, and now she's gone.
Yeah, so we've been talking a little bit more, you and I and Rich and with other people I know, about trauma. And I think there are things in life that we experience that are traumatic and we don't think of them that way, right? You think about, oh my God, a plane crash. Someone survives a plane crash. Wow, that must be traumatic. You go to war or any kind of war zone. Even if you're mm-hmm. not in active combat, you're just around it. Hear gunfire. How about people who live in these places where they hear gunshots?
Chicago.
Or we were watching a Chicago PD episode the other night, Rich and I. And I said, man, just think about that. These little kids go to sleep.
Hearing gunshots gunfire. All night.
So, and it becomes, oh, well, they're used to it. No, but that's traumatic.
Yeah, it increases cortisol levels and you learn to be living in a state of stress and anxiety at all times, pretty much.
So since you brought that up, as usual, our conversations are never planned. They just kind of happen. But that constant stress. So I can remember one point in Jamie's 15 years in her addiction, me just saying, I guarantee you, Rich, if I went to a psychologist right now, right out of the gate, they'd say to me, you have PTSD. I think now they call it PTS, whatever. Everyone knows PTS, PTSD. But there's no question in my mind. And I remember thinking that I just always thought of PTS as people coming back from the military and then they have to process. Okay, now I'm home and how do I process this stuff that's in my brain that I can't unsee and unhear and unknow? And then I'm thinking, I'm not comparing, but I'm thinking, mine's still going on. Like, you know, I'm still in the war. There's no end to it. So I feel like there's so much more trauma that we experience that we don't think about, right? We always think about it with mostly military. Mm-hmm. But everyday life, I think a lot of people have experienced trauma they don't even realize.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've started unpacking stuff from even when I was a little kid and our childhood family friend took his own life when he was 17 mm-hmm. years old, and his little brother was dealing with his own PTSD and traumas, demanded that I go into the room where they did an open casket and touch his brother's body and say goodbye to him. And he wanted me to do it his way, and I didn't have the emotional maturity to say, I don't understand an open casket. I'm horrified of a human body. I'm 12 years old. I don't want to see someone who I looked up to laying in a coffin, but I didn't know how to do that. And I went in there and touched his hand, and I'll never forget how his hand felt. I'll never forget how awful it was, how hard I cried. I remember running outside and running out into the gravesite to get away from him. And even that was traumatizing to me, and I didn't really admit that to myself until I was probably 30 years old.
Of course.
You know, at this point, it's happened 20-something years ago, and I'm still have a vivid memory of it.
That wasn't even
my own brother.
No, but then I wonder, now that you're saying this, I wonder if we have these little traumas, whatever I want to say, less major traumas or whatever, along with, and then we don't deal with them. You know, I told Rich today, I said, you know, I really should have had Sean in some kind of counseling during Jamie's addiction, or maybe even earlier when you had, you know, traumatic events with your dad.
You tried. There was a pastor at our church who was the youth pastor who we had. I had a few meetings with him and I tried, but it didn't work because I was just so angry at her at the time.
Right. Okay. So these things build and build and build. And then what? Okay. So since you said anger and as usual, you can tell your mom you can't tell your mom to shut up. But if you don't want to talk about something, you could say so, but that's not your style. But so since we're talking about anger, let's go backwards. My friends, you've listened to Sean talk about how his anger has really been difficult for him because this guy that murdered his sister, you know, he shot her 7 times. She was unarmed. She was defenseless, begging for her life. I mean, just the horror of that, of having to hear that at the preliminary hearing, we haven't even got to the trial yet, was so traumatic. But you go into such anger mode sometimes, but I want to like go reverse all the way back, because you were the happy little boy that would sit in my arms. If I didn't have another child or job or anything, you would have sat there all day just cuddling. You were so sweet and happy and always happy and smiling and wanting to have fun. Sadly for you, your idiot of a mom who married the wrong guy, but hey, you're here.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were one, I was divorced. But I mean, I feel like we had a really happy home, even though we, you know, I was divorced and all that. But you're the kind of person who needs to know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You make a plan and someone doesn't stick to the plan, it affects you. Jamie couldn't have cared less. So a perfect example is I'd go to the Montessori school on a Wednesday when your dad was supposed to pick you up and he's called me and said, whatever, you can't be there. And I'd walk in and Jamie, every time I picked you guys up, I'd go, Jamie, Sean, like that. And you'd come across the room. So Jamie come rolling over, jump in my arms, all excited to go home. Totally forgot her dad was picking her up. You would stand over. That's when I really saw this anger come up in you. You would stand there with your little hands on your hips, your fists on your hips, and literally going like this, like breathing in, like the anger you felt over the disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't even know, I mean, if we'd consider that traumatic, but I feel like that was the beginning of you feeling anger towards something.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I wouldn't be able to pinpoint where that came from. That could be as relevant of a reason as any that I've dealt with that, but it has most certainly made me sensitive to anyone not sticking to their word, because that happened so much when I was younger that made me really, really very, very intolerant of what I deem as disrespectful to my time or dishonest or whatever. I'm not sitting at the end of the driveway waiting for someone to show up ever again.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess there is probably something to that.
Well, it's kind of interesting because now that I think about it, as you're talking about it, I go, wait, I did the same thing with my dad, only I sat on the couch looking out and he just wouldn't come on a Friday night. And, you know, I'm so far past that. I'm like, yeah, whatever.
Well, thankfully I had a lot better dad than you.
Yeah. 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 Mine was pretty bad. But I guess what I'm saying is that every little thing along the way has impact on us somehow. Mm-hmm. And obviously we can't sit around blaming our childhood for everything and, you know, being angry over things that happened so long ago. But we have to recognize that all of these little things pile up and pile up and pile up, especially if we don't deal with them. Right? So now, fast forward to Jamie was shot the first time. I know you guys, you were talking today, Sean, you told me that you were telling your therapist that you just started on working with, that you have these out-of-body experiences like I do. And I was trying to explain it to Rich, and he was looking at me like I was an alien.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how to explain properly what an out-of-body experience feels like.
The best way I could explain it is it's almost like the Matrix is real, and for just a moment, you have this lucidity where you look down at almost like a simulation of your life and think, there's no way this is actually happening. And then the harder part of that is when reality comes back and says, no, this is real. And you have to go, holy shit, she's dead. Someone yes. shot her.
Or do you ever feel like you hear the words and they're your voice and you're saying things? But the mm-hmm. first time it happened was the first time she was shot, and we were at Harborview at the emergency hospital, and all these people were calling me, and I'd go, Jamie's been shot. And it's the first time I experienced this where I would go, oh, that's my voice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that. How in the hell could our life be this, and how did it get here? And so what I was saying then is that my reaction was to go right into guilt mode. How come I couldn't save Jamie? And I felt so, I mean, my heart was shattered into a million pieces, and, you know, the shame of it because she was shot by a gang member and just all sorts of horrible stuff. Now, she's been crashing for 3 years, and I don't even know if I've really talked to you about this much. She's already been crashing for 3 years. Smartest person I know. She doesn't play softball anymore. She quit school, you know, all the stuff, youth group and everything. So mine is to try to save her and fix her, and I'm feeling so disappointed. Were you really aware of what was going on that much back then? And were you feeling angry too? Were you feeling disappointed that your sister was like that, embarrassed?
Yeah.
Or just probably, mad at her?
Probably all of the above, because being 2 years apart, we went to the same elementary school, I think, for 1 year, or middle school for 1 year, and then the same high school for what should have been her junior and senior year, and she transferred schools after junior year. But because of that, all the kids in the neighborhood there were so many people that were 2 years older. The brother played on the football team. He and I played together. His younger sister was my friend. And we were so like intertwined that people would constantly ask me like, what's going on with her? What's the deal with her? And it was tough to be like, you know, yeah, well, she thinks she's a gang member, even though we live in like standard suburbia. And she's hanging out with these people and doing this stuff. And so there was definitely embarrassment, which made me very resentful of her.
Isn't that weird how we take on other people's actions because they're related to us?
Yeah.
Like it's our responsibility.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, there's other things, like, without getting into too much detail, and I won't say the people's names, but I still remember them. I got into a couple fist fights with a couple of people who, for whatever reason, decided to hurl a nasty comment to me about Jamie and them involving and stuff when she was 16 years old and I was 14. And I got, you know, I mean, it literally turned into actual physical violence and anger because one of the kids said something and I said something back. He ran up at me on a hiking trail near our house, tried to hit me with a rock, and I punched him and threw him down the hill. And like, there was all this. And then people found out, ooh, I can poke Sean about that and get a reaction. But if I'm in a group of like eight, he won't hit me. So then people started trying to get me mad. The older upperclassmen.
Why?
Thank God a couple of her friends Ryan Brennan, I will shout him out if he ever hears this. Nothing but a gem, that guy, unbelievable human being. He would immediately defend Jamie and me every single time. But the problem is, I still remember the names of the people who poked and prodded. And all of that, I felt like, I just remember thinking, this is her fault. I didn't take to them, this is their actions of an insecure person who's hurting for their own purposes. And one of the guys, I can tell you, is no longer with us because of fentanyl. He became a drug dealer and a drug addict and passed. So, obviously he had his own things, but I'm 14, 15, 16. I don't have the emotional maturity to understand, oh, hurt people. You're just trying to hurt me because that way it takes the light off of you.
And yeah, isn't it funny how they were so judgmental, but the reason I'm a little sympathetic to that, although forget that, kids are just mean and that's ridiculous what they did to you. I mean, ridiculous that you would take somebody's family's anguish, but I don't think they're thinking of it like that, because I can remember without question looking at people like that, those kind of people, like Jamie, who were addicted to drugs, who were doing illegal things, who were doing bad things, and thinking, what kind of parents? What kind of family? That's my first thought, was always, where, what kind of a family do they come from? And I think it's because I wanted some kind of an answer. Because it can't happen to me. Because she comes from, you know, my kids come from this family. Oh, I get why they're like that. They came from that family. And then to be that family. And so maybe they kind of were like that too.
Yeah.
And I know that you had to take the brunt of Jamie's actions with some of the parents of your friends, because they had the assumption that we must be a bad family.
Yep.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of... I can actually, as I'm thinking about it, I can pinpoint a way that it made me really angry and affected me. It was right after the first time she was shot. I was a sophomore going into my junior year, so I'm 16. And we had mandatory football practice if you wanted to start that year. And I basically didn't call in and didn't tell the coach anything. When I heard Jamie was shot, I didn't go to like 2 weeks of practice.
Imagine that.
It was 3 days a week. And when I went back, the coach told me that I owed them a bunch of punishments for no showing practices. And I had to do all this extra running and all this extra lifting. And I remember being so angry at them for not just understanding that I had a good reason to not show.
I think they should have.
That in retrospect, I think I had the right to feel pretty angry about that. But then it made me even more resentful of Jamie, because now you're affecting football, which is the sport that I was good at. I was going to be a full starter junior year, but because I didn't come to those practices, they told me I wasn't allowed to start. I got into it with another coach. I was so angry at them for not being supportive. I told one of them to go F himself. And then my coach told me, I'm going to bench you for the entire year. You're not going to play a single varsity snap. And if you can make it through that, I'll give you a chance to play next year. And I hung in there and I did it. But I think about that, like,
and this is all Jamie's fault, really.
That's how I was feeling, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was tough because I probably would have started for 2 years, gotten more looks at colleges, but that wasn't the journey for me, I guess.
Well, there's so much fallout from the trauma of in the family that people don't understand. I mean, if you're listening to this and you have this going on in your family, I want you to know that we understand. If no one in your whole world and no one in your whole life understands, we understand. And I think it's important for you to let people know and help them understand. You can't expect them to. They've never been through all this stuff. But when you mention college, I'm going, I've had a lot of regret that I wasn't going, let's talk about college. And I know you did Running Start and all that, but I was trying to survive. Even though I was doing it with a smile on my face, I was internally dying. I couldn't figure out how to save Jamie. And so I was worthless, you know, for giving you more direction. And I'm not going to take responsibility because I know you're old enough to whatever. But I still feel like I should have given you more direction. So the whole thing is just really, in a lot of ways, the whole thing's a shit show when you're dealing with this kind of ongoing trauma, I guess I would call it.
Yeah, it's true. I don't think that even talking about college planning would have been an option for me. I realize now I was pretty determined to just get out of Issaquah. I didn't want to be there anymore. I didn't want to be around the people that had these preconceived notions about me or Jamie or whatever. Because if you think about, after I graduated, I moved to my dad's for a little bit, moved down to Miami with you, back to Tallahassee, back to Miami, back to Seattle, to Southern California, back to Seattle, and then finally to Phoenix, where I've been for a decade now. But I never sat still. I never lived in Issaquah again. I didn't want to go back there. I wanted nothing to do with that place because it was associated to bad times for me. And now I couldn't live there if I wanted to because it's one of the most expensive places in the country. Right. But
you know how you say that? That's how I feel about, because I ended up living in Palm Desert, which is the Palm Springs, California area, for people that might not know, for a decade. And we brought Jamie down there a year after we were there thinking, oh, we remove her from this horrible situation. I can't send any more money to Seattle. We'll bring her down there and everything.
We'll move her to a border state where they have no drugs.
Right. And then, yeah, exactly. Don't get me started on the border. Let's do a whole nother conversation about what's coming across that border every minute of every day. But anyway, so Jamie found her people. I think Rich and I kind of touched on that in that episode. Jamie found her people quick. And we all know all of the, not all of, most of the most horrific memories of the traumatic experience of my daughter's addiction happened there. And she was murdered there. And the Palm Springs area is 9 cities, but they're really towns. I don't know how you even call them towns. They're tiny. They're all small. It's a small area. And she died there. And so, and then, you know, going to the courthouse and all that. It's really weird. When I moved from there to here, I cried when I crossed the border. And we still have family there. We have friends there. We have people who have houses there. We have people who want to go there. And I keep saying I'm done with the place. And it's a great place. There's a lot of great things there. But it's kind of like what you just said about mm-hmm. Issaquah. It must be the trauma that's imprinted in me is so associated with, especially the town of Indio, that particular town mm-hmm. over there, that I don't want to be there. I feel like I just want to go back for the trial and not go there ever again.
Yeah, I think that I would feel the same way, and I didn't even live there. It's just that whole entire area is just burned for me forever. Because how could you possibly drive down a street in a city right near where your sister was murdered, your daughter was murdered, and not be thinking about that? So when you're not there, when I'm driving through Phoenix, which looks just like Southern California,
yeah.
I'm not thinking about that most of the time. There's not many associations that, you know, it's like, you know, 5, 6, 7 times a day I think about Jamie. When I'm in Southern California, it's nothing but that the entire time, weighing on you. That's all you're thinking about. So I think it's normal to associate painful memories to location and place and time.
So I want to ask you this, Sean, since we've been talking about trauma a little bit more lately too, and the things that we've been through. So weird. I watched these 48 Hours in Dateline, and I have this kind of disassociated viewpoint when I watch the other moms, and they're going, my life is never be the same. You know, it's ruined. He's destroyed my life, you know, and they have children murdered. And I think, oh, you poor thing. And then I think, oh my gosh, that's me.
Oh shit.
Yeah. It's so weird to think that I somehow am able to do that, but it's all still there. And it's kind of weird because 7.5 years later, lately, a lot of this stuff has been purging out of me. But what we've been talking about is needing to get to trial. And so, you know how they talk about closure and people go, well, there's no closure when someone dies. But we have a guy who's been sitting in jail now for 4 years. He wasn't arrested for 2.5 years. He was on the lam. Well, he was busy killing someone in Arizona, by the way.
Isn't it almost 5 that he's been?
He was arrested on March 8th of 2019.
Okay.
Yeah, so 4 years.
So it'll be 4 years, 2 days after my birthday.
Right. And, you know, the right to a speedy trial means that you should be having, you know, you can go to trial within, I think, 60 days. He waived that a long time ago. There's a whole bunch of bull crap that he's pulling on the system. I guess he likes the county jail a lot. So we haven't gotten to trial yet. We've been through 3 DAs so far, and we're starting to lose a little bit of heart on, you know, getting a little disheartened on what will happen. But I do feel like that for us to get to trial, it's not going to be closure completely, because at least in Riverside County in California, we're told the appellate process, if he is convicted, especially if it's first degree murder, it could be up to 9 years before the appeal process is exhausted.
Well,
that means before the ink is really dry on his sentencing.
And the reality of the situation is, given his history, we know that he's killed other people as well, including one in Arizona. Simple Google will search that out if anyone's interested. We know, we've heard from other people, he's killed more people in California that we don't mm-hmm. know about. So what we do know, and apologies to the super Christians on here who don't like cursing, but we know he's a world-class shitbag. And he's absolutely going to fight back against his conviction to the fullest extent of the law and try to take zero. So we know that 9 years is happening. If he's convicted, we're already expecting.
Oh, he's going to go through the whole thing.
But then there's this poor family in Arizona who he killed someone a couple of years after he killed Jamie, who's going to have to wait till our process ends to even begin their process. They're going to have to wait probably 20 years before it's
sickening.
He might die before he even gets sent back to Arizona.
Or someone in their family dies and they don't get to have that so-called closure. And by the way, what I wanted to say when Sean goes to Super Christians, I feel like I'm a Super Christian, but I've talked to some of my Super Christian friends who've been through this, not the murder journey, but the addiction journey. And trust me, the four-letter words come rolling out of their mouth, too.
When the Bible was written, the English language didn't exist, and none of those words are mentioned in it. So those are man-made words, not God-made words. So
that's what we're standing on.
There you go.
No, no. People who listen to my podcast already know that I can't help myself. Listen, my mom's favorite word was S-H-I-T when I was a kid, so I'm blaming her. But anyway, so talking about this needing closure, it's only just closure of one kind. But here's the real reason I think we need closure, Sean. Because of what we're going to have to face.
Mm-hmm.
It's the trauma. So you know how when you have a test for something that could potentially be serious, a blood test or whatever, a medical test, and they go, well, we'll have the results in a week.
Anticipation, thinking, anxiety.
Yeah. You're thinking, I need the results now. I can't take the next week. I feel like it's more stressful than if you have to deal with whatever, you know, the results are. And so I feel like for us too, we've been waiting for almost 8 years now for this day in court. But what happened was a year ago, we had a preliminary hearing, and now we get it. We understand what a day in court, by the way, ours, we're told, is going to be a month long. So when we get our month in court, I guess we should call it, we just got a little taste of what that month is going to be like. And I was told sometime by one of the DAs in the back before, they said, aside from your daughter's death, this will be the hardest thing you ever do in your life. I had no idea until we got the taste of it for that full day of the preliminary hearing. Mm-hmm. So we're not just going, we want to get to trial. Our anxiety is we know what it's going to be like. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, we know it's going to be traumatic. Well,
and talk about anticipation anxiety. Having heard eyewitness testimony, sitting next to the guy, seeing crime scene photographs, a couple of us saw. You think, God, I can't wait for this to be over. And now here we are 13 months later. There's no court date set, no nothing. So we know how bad it's going to be. And we've had to just wallow in that until, who knows, it might not happen until 2025, 2026. He could push this out for 2 more years. So then we have to sit there and wait in this anticipation for 3 years. Then finally, our reward is to go hear all the nasty details and listen to his defense attorney try to act like it was Jamie's fault that she was shot while unarmed in the face. You know, that's going to be really fun.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no question about, it's just weird. You and I talked about it just recently, and I said to Rich, oh my gosh, that preliminary hearing was traumatic. That day alone could cause someone to have PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
Literally. I mean, that one day, like, you know, Sean, when they said the officer got up to testify about what happened, and that we saw the diagrams of where all the bullet casings were. And so they knew there were 7 shots and she was shot once. And then all the rest of the casings were elsewhere, which meant she was shot once and still alive. And then we could hear the testimony, you know, that she's begging for her life. And then the matter of fact testimony is, tell us about the shots. Well, the first shot was, you know, like in her hip or something like that. And then she was shot in the face. And I just got up and left the courtroom. I thought, I can't even unhear that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't unhear that my daughter was brutally murdered like that. I don't give a rat's ass if she were in addiction and doing illegal things and whatever she was doing. That is absolutely unacceptable behavior from a human being.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so I had to leave. And then, so that whole thing was traumatic to hear, to
talking about,
experience.
But, sorry to interrupt.
But then what you saw.
Talking about anger, like we've been talking about on this.
Yeah.
As you were talking about that, I wasn't even listening to you. I was zoning out and re-envisioning a day with that trial, that day when we were at the pretrial thing. And I recreated the scenario where I stood up and screamed at him to shut his stupid fat mouth when he was arguing with someone and had to be dragged out of the courtroom because I tried to kick him in the face. I literally just, as we're sitting here talking about dealing with it,
it's
I literally had
anger.
Like a daydream where I got to put my hands on him.
So it's really bringing up a lot for you. It's anger.
It's very hard to sit 15 feet away from someone who brutally murdered your sister, knowing that I have the physical capability to beat him to death with my bare hands, and there's nothing he could do to stop me if we were alone, literally nothing, but that that's not the right thing to do, that it wouldn't help anyone, and there's no way that that's a reality or a possibility. And I'd be lying if I said I don't wish ill on him. I do. I want the worst for him in life. I would love to physically harm him, but the reality is I can't. I won't. And that's hard to swallow. Now I have this anger that I can't let out because it's illegal, it's wrong, whatever you want to say. So, yeah, there's a pretty serious reality that I'll probably hold on to that for a long time, maybe forever, who knows, if I'll ever be able to fully not want to hurt him.
Yeah, I mean, I do understand that I'm different because I'm not, you know, a big, strong person like you, but the first time I saw him, you didn't see him the first time I did, which I saw him because you lived in Arizona, I lived in California, and he was arrested on Friday, and on Tuesday morning, he was in his arraignment. And, you know, they always tell you, you don't need to go to this, you don't need to go to that. They really don't, a lot of times, want the family there in certain things because it's disruptive or can be. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there was no one in the courtroom but him and the, at the time, a defense, what do you call him?
District attorney, no, defense attorney. Defense attorney.
No, but he didn't have a defense attorney, a public defender.
Oh, the PD.
And a judge and a couple bailiffs and us. And I have to honestly say that as I walked in the room and I yelled out to him, which I wasn't supposed to, and then got in trouble from the bailiff, but I honestly wanted to punch him in the head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have to honestly say that. I'm not a violent person, but I wanted to punch him in the head. So I think that's okay. Honestly, I think that we have to remember that anger is not always a bad thing, because the reason that we have, you know, we had social reform back, you know, when Martin Luther King and all, you don't think there was some anger involved in all that?
Mm-hmm.
Or the reason that people go in and help, you know, rescue sex trafficking victims.
Mm-hmm.
It starts out because someone got pissed off,
yeah,
and said, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. Right. And we want. And so I think that there's a part of all of us that wants justice because it restores order in the world.
Yeah.
And now here you are, this person going, I have no control. And that's one of the things I talk about in my 9 Weapons of Hope. There's a whole weapon on it about control, because the bottom line in life is we have very little control over anything. And that is hard to take.
Well, and everybody says it wouldn't bring her back and all that. And I'm like, yeah, but it'd be really fun to kick his head in and call all my friends and tell him I whooped his ass. I'm not going to lie. Sorry, I had to bring a little levity.
No, I mean, I get it. I understand. So, yeah, I mean, I just think that anyone who's, you know, we just came in here to just jam about whatever, you know, and hopefully this wasn't just a big waste of your time. But I think anybody who's listening to this and goes, I understand where they are. I don't have someone who's murdered, but I've been through something, whatever it is.
They all understand anger. Everyone listening,
yes,
is dealing with someone in addiction, has been mad at the person for being a drug abuser, has been mad at the dealers for selling it to him, has been mad at the people that bring it across the border, been mad at
the government, the friend, is not stopping it.
The first friend they got in trouble smoking pot with, because it's, you just start looking for things to be mad at. I think it's completely normal. It's just a matter of making sure you can't act on the anger, because it's not going to help.
And you can't let it ruin the rest of your life. No. You can't be an angry about
when
everything.
I have those moments where I'm furious and I want to smash him, I allow myself to go to that place, think about it, and let it all out in that moment, and then move on. I don't just try to stuff it away as if it's not happening. I acknowledge it to myself, like, okay, let's do this. Let's go through the scenario in your head. I picture me just smashing his head in, and then I don't actually do it because I allow myself to bask in it, process it, let it go.
That's good, because I think in the past, you let your anger be carried into other areas of your life, just like I let my guilt be carried into other areas.
If he had done this 14 years ago, and we were sitting in that courtroom when I was 23 years old, I'd absolutely run across the courtroom, jumped over the thing, tackled him, and while they're pulling me off, I'd have bit his ear off or something. I mean, he's a piece of him's going with me one way or another. I didn't have the maturity then to say, you know, well, now I'm going to go to jail for 6 months for battery or whatever. So I think that's part of it too, is like, you just learn to deal with it as you get older.
Yeah, you have to. But I'm really glad though that you said you're starting to talk to someone about, you know, just have someone else to talk to besides me, besides the family, that you can kind of talk to about the trauma, because I think what happens for a lot of us is that everyone else just goes on with their life, and no one around you knows what it's like to go through what we're going through. Mm-hmm. So we just kind of fall in step with other people and try to keep doing life like they do life. But recently, I wanted to talk about one last thing, because I think this is a gift that we give people, is I told Rich, when the trial comes, and he looked at me like, really, you're going to do that? I said, when it's time for the trial, I'm going to reach out to every, you know, good friend, family member, everyone, and just tell them, we would so appreciate you coming to some part of the trial. Some part of this month. I'll have a calendar. And I'm going to pitch it out there like, we have never asked for anything from anyone on this, and we need you. And I think it's good for the jury to see all of you there. And, you know, I'm going to reach out and do that. And that's hard for me. I don't ask for help. But I think, and then, you know, the thought is, well, that's going to be uncomfortable for them. Then I'm going to say that. We know it's going to be hard for you to sit in a courtroom in a murder trial. But we need that support. And then what it allows them to do is an opportunity to do something uncomfortable because it's the right thing to do for someone.
Yeah.
And that really, I don't know if I would have done this had you not told me that recently you've been telling some family members specifically that we're not feeling the love.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not trying to be victims about this, but it turned out that it was a gift when you told these people,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, by the way, a quick side note, I did the same thing. I texted like 8 of my friends who live in Phoenix, all the cousins back in Washington, and asked them one day to have just like a show of force for Jamie. We'd just have, and it also doesn't hurt that my two cousins are both considerably larger than me, so he'll turn around and see a small army there to protect Jamie and multiple people who could snatch his life. So there's a little bit of that in there, a little bit of my meathead DNA coming out. But I recently expressed to, and I know sometimes he listens to these, so if you're listening, Robbie and Erica, shout out to you guys. I expressed it to, he's my oldest cousin, and he's a person who will listen to you. He's a thoughtful person. So the conversation started, I was having with someone else, another cousin, basically expressing that I feel like everyone else just moved on with their lives, doesn't really seem to care. And I said, maybe it's not fair of me to feel that way. It's maybe I'm just, you know, projecting on other people, but ultimately that's how it feels, like everyone else just moved on. And I said to Robbie, you know, can you imagine if Ryan, who's his brother, was killed and everyone just kind of carried on about their lives and never talked about him? And to his credit, he thought about it for a good long while and said, yeah, I can't even imagine. That's insane. That would ruin my life. And I was like, exactly. That's how we feel. And after that, both he and his wife made sure to message me on her birthday. They listened to what I said and made a positive effect. So I think I was able to completely let go of that because I expressed it to a few other people too. And I heard from those people as well.
Right.
They listened. They heard me. They just didn't know that I was hurting, that I was upset, that you were hurting or upset, because it isn't their immediate world.
And, but we, the don't, moment and I we don't talk about it that much.
Yeah, and the moment I expressed it to him, that like, hey, maybe I'm unfairly resentful, but this is where I'm how I'm feeling, I was surprised how many people rose to the occasion. So
I'm really appreciate that you did that, because you did something that was actually more mature than your, you know, almost 62-year-old mother. Because I am the kind that goes, if I say to Rich, well, you know, you don't do whatever, then he'll go, oh, well, here, let me do that. And I go, well, I don't want you to do it because I had to tell you. So it's that same thing. If I have to tell them to care on Jamie's angel anniversary or birthday or whatever, if I have to tell them that they should ask about the trial, then I don't want them to. That's kind of that old Valerie protecting herself from the little girl, you know, disappointment and everything. But what it turned out to me, the biggest lesson was that you gave them all a gift.
If I tell someone something's important to me and then they change to accommodate that thing, that's the same as Karen. Whether it was an immediate top of mind thing for them, and they can't understand because Ryan is still alive, thank God. But if the situation were reversed, who knows if I would be always thinking about those dates. I mean, you would now
because you understand.
Yeah, now. But, right. But I'm saying this retrospectively as the person who has lost someone. So it's unfair to say that I would be better. The reality is I asked them to make an effort to care more, and they immediately did. And that to me is plenty well enough. That's all I really wanted, was just someone to acknowledge her. Because my biggest fear since the moment she was murdered, people don't want to say, Jamie hey, I'm really sorry about that thing that happened, is what a lot of people would say. I'm really sorry about what happened. And I go, not what happened. Her name was Jamie. She was my sister. She was murdered. Don't call her what happened, because then she'll disappear. She'll fade away, be nothing but a memory. She won't continue to stay alive. I want to talk about it. I want it brought up. I want it. So
I feel that same way, Sean, about that's such good stuff. And I really feel like if I could go back and do one thing differently, but I couldn't have, I didn't know, but this is what you just talked about taught me this. If I could go back, and so if one person hears this and is able to do this, please do it. If you have a son or a daughter in addiction or a family member that's still alive, okay, because all the stuff we talked about was, you know, after they're gone. If you have someone that's still alive, do the same thing. You don't have to talk about their addiction. You don't have to talk about the latest, you know, Jerry Springer episode. Talk about them as a person.
I can tell you, too, don't be accusatory or blame the person. The way that I express myself is, hey, this is just how I'm feeling. Maybe it's unfair of me to feel this way, but I just had to tell you this is how I feel. I was shockingly well received by pretty much everyone that I said that to, because sometimes we'll get angry and go, you don't care about, you don't give up, and you start doing this finger pointing accusation.
And then people get defensive.
I've said this on this before, but one of my mentors, one of the first people that ever mentored me, I was bitching and moaning about something, and he told me to point at him. And I pointed at him, and he said, do you see those three fingers pointing back at you?
Ah.
Your attitude is the problem. Not me, not anyone else, you. And sometimes when we attack people like that, there's three fingers pointing back at us.
Yeah, but if you're pointing like a gun, people. That's what he's showing it like a gun. Yeah. Three fingers are pointing back at you.
Hold your hand out and point. You'll see what I mean. But if you think about, if somebody were to say to you, hey, maybe it's unfair of me to feel this way, but I just want you to know that this is kind of hurtful to me. No sane human being is going to go, nah, you're wrong, you're an idiot.
Totally. Yeah,
everyone's going to hear you and go, I didn't even know that was a problem. I'm sorry, I'll do better. Most
people,
unless you're a sociopath or something. It's,
right. Okay, and don't you also wish, though, that I wish if I could go back, that I would have known this and done this while she was alive and while she was in her addiction. I wish we would have just talked about Jamie, not about her addiction, not about... I wish we would have just kept talking about the Jamie that we knew,
I wish I would have talked to her. Even if she was high and on... I wish it took me, her dying, and all these other people dying, and for me to truly understand what addiction meant, that it completely hijacked her personality and her body and her brain. So that's another thing, too, is I wish... There's so many things that I... There was years where she was alive, and I could message her on Facebook, or I had her phone number, and I chose not to say a word. And I regret that.
So that's what you would do differently if you could go back.
I would have communicated how I was feeling early and often in a non-communicative way, because the reason that I was angry, I never told my dad that I was upset that he would no-show sometimes. I never told Jamie that I was resentful of her for putting me through a harder high school experience because of her choices. I never told you guys that I was resentful that she was 100% encompassing your lives. And I mean, at one point, I was just kind of a free agent. I could do whatever I wanted. You guys were so worried about Jamie, which I thought was cool, but I didn't realize I was resentful of that. And I harbored all this stuff, and it resulted in a period of time where I would go out into public places and bars and stuff, and I would commit violence against other people if somebody pushed me or did something I didn't like. And that's not who I am at all.
You just let it out.
That's not who I am at all. I'm not a fighter. I haven't touched anybody in 15 years. But back then, I was so angry because I internalized all this stuff. And I realize as I'm expressing it to people, as long as you don't do it from a place of anger, vitriol, hatred, whatever, most people are pretty receptive to hear you go, like, man, I had no idea that was bothering you. And then once they say that and you let it out, you're like, okay, I just got, you know, 1/4 pound lighter. There it is. A little bit of weight off. So
very, very good advice. So I'm pretty sure this is going to resonate with a lot of people out there. I hope you will share this podcast with other people, whether or not they have the same journey as me or you. I think it can help. Everybody has trauma. Everybody has experiences. Everybody needs help and support sometimes. Wherever you are in the world, never forget you are not alone, because me and Sean are standing right there with you.